You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I suspect that as long as there have been humans, there's been infidelity and addiction with adaptations to each era's leaps in technology. In her short story collection for Grove Press, I Want to Show You More, Jamie Quatro explores the themes of faith, love, and what constitutes infidelity in the digital age. Her work has appeared in many literary journals and magazines, including The New Yorker and The Oxford American. I'm very pleased that it brings Jamie Quatro to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Now, you've published many more stories in various literary journals than you've included here. How did you decide which ones to put in this collection? Is it because you were looking for certain themes?
Yes, I think that I did try to look for certain stories that were thematically linked. Certainly infidelity stories were a thematic thread throughout the book. And with the help of my agent, we selected certain others and put them together.
And when you begin a story, do you have a theme in mind, or is that something that you discover?
Typically, it's something I discover. I usually start a story with maybe an image, maybe a voice, maybe a line of dialogue. And as the story begins to come, it usually isn't until I'm about two-thirds of the way through where I start to see what it really might be about.
Well, the big question that writers dread is how autobiographical are these stories? Well, considering the fact that one of the themes throughout much of these stories is infidelity. I'm not going to ask you that question.
I appreciate that.
But faith is another one.
Yes.
Can I ask you about that?
Sure. As far as my own personal faith, I'm not a confessor and going to talk about, you know, what I believe. But certainly within the stories and within the collection, I think it's an important discussion. I do think that there's been perhaps a lack of looking at Christianity and Christian characters with sort of an authenticity or a compassion in literature. I don't know if you saw Paul Eli's recent article, Has Fiction Lost Its Faith? And I did read that and agree with much of it, though I do think there are writers, David Means being one of them, who are doing some symbolic things. But I do think that fiction needs to show a wrestling with faith. As Flannery O'Connor said, one must wrestle with it until one extracts a blessing.
Well, your work is often described as Southern literature and has been compared to Flannery O'Connor. Now, you can read Flannery O'Connor with an awareness of her Catholic faith or ignore that and just read them as powerful short stories. Mm-hmm. But you actually refer to faith more than she did.
Right. It's a little more overt in my work.
People are often saying, well, you should talk to your pastor, or
yes,
or maybe you should check with God on that kind of thing.
Yes.
Although many of these stories follow different characters, there is one woman whose story is a constant thread throughout the book. But you never give her a name. Mm-hmm. You sometimes refer to her as you, other times as she. And her stories detail a long-distance affair with a married man conducted largely over the internet and the phone. Why did you decide to have her do this electronically?
Mm-hmm. Right, and not an actual affair. I think it's a question that the digital age has raised. What constitutes infidelity? It used to be in yesteryear that you would have to go to a hotel and have this physical interaction or some kind of a meeting. In the digital age, that need for physical connection has been removed. And so this question is there, well, what constitutes unfaithfulness? Some people would say, if you're not hurting anyone and no one's touching, maybe it is an infidelity.
But in her case, these phone calls, emails, text messages, also nude photographs.
Yes.
A husband might feel betrayed if he knew that his wife was doing that sort of thing. So the physical side is only one aspect of it. Is it a mental thing, infidelity as well?
I think so. I think that that's a question that the stories definitely raise.
Is communicating through new technologies all that different than from sending sexy letters with some photographs included in the past?
I would say it's not that different.
Could that character have been the subject of a novel rather than a series of short stories?
That has been suggested. When I started out, I didn't think at all in terms of a novel. I was just writing one story to the next without thinking about any kind of big picture project. But I do think that at some point along the way, when I started seeing all of these stories emerge, that I thought, well, novel and stories perhaps might be a way of thinking about them.
And publishers prefer novels, don't they?
People have said that, but my experience so far has been that there's a great interest in the short story form. It's what I'm passionate about, and I hope that that continues.
Well, the problem is that the venues for publishing short stories have dwindled over the past few years. So you're probably sending these stories to 5 or 6 publications.
Yes, especially in the beginning. When I first started out, I had, you know, I'd send out 15 stories and get all of them back rejections.
Now, we mentioned the betrayal aspect of having even a long-distance affair. Mm-hmm. It's not, doesn't involve two people. It involves the spouses of the people who are engaged in the affair.
Yes, yes.
And one of these stories right at the start of the collection is about a husband who discovers that his wife has been communicating with a man long-distance.
Oh, are you decomposition?
Yes.
The one with the corpse? Yes, she actually confesses to her husband. It's not so much that he discovers it, but that she, in that moment, decides to tell the truth. And they come home and find the lover's physical corpse in their marital bed.
I thought that was metaphorical. I didn't realize that it was actually a corpse there.
I mean, it's a little of both.
Since many of these stories deal with infidelity and how marital indiscretions play out against the background of Christian faith, how does your own faith or religion inform this kind of writing?
Mm-hmm. It has always flummoxed me a little bit that on the one hand you have these kind of strictures against sexual behavior, and on the other, the actual scriptural text is rife with sexual image and metaphor. So you have the return of Christ figured as the consummation between a bride and a bridegroom. Or you have quotes from Christ such as, "Unless you consume me, you have no part in me." So it seems that there is something inherently erotic about the way we're supposed to think of God and the way he thinks of us. And I think that that has been artificially separated, and I'm interested in exploring that.
Well, the people of the Bible aren't always faithful to their spouses in the Old Testament.
Correct.
Anyway. And you do make many theological references in these mm-hmm. stories. Mm-hmm. So you're making a point here.
Mm. I'm keenly interested in theology. I read it a lot. Flannery O'Connor said that she reads a lot of theology because it makes her a bolder writer, and I find the same thing.
And then we have the third story in the collection is called Ladies and Gentlemen of the Pavement, which describes a marathon for which the runners are forced to carry cumbersome phallic statues and are punished if they choose to unload their burden. When I read that, I was thinking either this is about, to some degree, a reference to the story of Jesus, or maybe a reference to the Christian theological idea that every person has a cross to bear.
Yes, that story began with an image I saw online of a race somewhere in Europe, I wish I remembered where the runners had to have crucifixes on their backs. And that image haunted me. And at the time, I was reading Barry Hannah, and so I think that kind of Barry Hannah voice merged with that image. I did not start out writing that story wanting to make any kind of a theological point. But again, I do think once a story is in the world, it belongs to the reader, and that collision between reader and text creates meaning. So I don't want to offer too much about what I think it means, but that is certainly an interpretation.
Well, this doesn't apply just to Christianity. There are any number of religions that somehow mix pain and bearing a heavy burden and religiosity.
Absolutely.
The stories in the collection are all set in your current home of is that hometown, Lookout Mountain?
I live there now, have lived there for 7 years, but my hometown is actually Tucson, Arizona.
But you don't live in Tucson?
No, I live in Lookout Mountain, Georgia.
So how this is on the border between Tennessee and Georgia?
Yes.
How does living in a border town influence your writing and thinking?
Well,
because Georgia, to me, Georgia and Tennessee are very different kinds of states. Maybe this is an area where they merge.
Absolutely. I do think that border towns become places of both confluence and division. So we are one town, Lookout Mountain, 5,000 people, and we share things like the Commons Park. We share the annual baseball parade. But there are very kind of distinctive things about each side. So on the Tennessee side, there's a leash law for the dogs. There isn't one on the Georgia side. You pay state income taxes on the Tennessee side. You don't on the Georgia side. But the property taxes are higher on the Georgia side. And so I think that those physical boundaries and confluences do inform perhaps some of the thematic things going in the collection.
And since you come from Tucson, do you think of yourself now as a writer in the Southern literary tradition?
I think it depends how you define Southern writer. If it's somebody with deep ancestral roots in the South, or certainly somebody who was born and raised there, then I don't qualify. If a Southern writer is someone concerned with historically Southern topics such as racial tension, religion, the Gothic and grotesque, then absolutely. I think of Eudora Welty. Her parents were not from the South, and it gave her a sort of clear-eyed vision, I think, that served her work. And perhaps in our increasingly homogenized America, it is the transplants who can recognize those unique regional distinctives and preserve them.
And it cuts both ways. A lot of the most famous Southern writers wrote about the South in New York or other places.
Absolutely.
Tennessee Williams, Truman Capote. Faulkner was writing about it while he was living in Los Angeles, writing screenplays.
Absolutely. And it raises the question, I did ask one of my mentors, Jill McCorkle, who I'll be reading with tonight, actually, at the Center for Fiction. Jill, do I have a right to do this? Because she's obviously born and raised in the South. And she kind of gave me permission early on. She said, you have a right to do it. There's also an aspect of raising children in a place. We moved there when they were all very young. I think that you own the place, perhaps, a little differently because you're entering into it through the lives of your children.
Well, how much do you writers writing about the South write in kind of broad, exaggerated terms about grotesques. You had to resist that. You really did try to understand these people, despite the fact that you might have disagreed with some of them?
Perhaps. I'm not sure I was even aware of resisting any kind of stereotypes or exaggerations. I think I was just trying to work one story to the next and tell the truth with each one.
In the final story, which is called Holy Ground, you address the issues of poverty and segregation. In recent weeks, there have been news stories about the racially tense issue in Atlanta's mostly white and affluent neighborhoods. They want to secede from the city, which is majority African-American, and that would cause a lot of trouble for Atlanta because they are the source of most of the tax revenue. As a resident of Georgia, how does segregation or attitudes about segregation and poverty, how aware are you of that?
Unfortunately, I'm keenly aware. Lookout Mountain is predominantly white, predominantly affluent, though that does change as you head out toward the back of the mountain toward Alabama. And that story, Holy Ground, really did come out of my discomfort with the fact that at the very base of our mountain is a town called Alton Park. It's a project, and it's, you know, completely African-American. They're looking up at us, and we're looking down at them, and that topographical distinction really bothered me.
Well, we have a case going before the Supreme Court, and people are arguing that attitudes about race have changed over the years.
That would be an interesting thing to posit on Lookout Mountain.
So write a letter to Antonine Scalia. Your writing has been described by James Wood of The New Yorker as possessing a fearless lyricism, and music is a recurring theme throughout this book. Are you a musician?
I am. I'm a classical pianist and the daughter of a concert pianist.
So music, faith.
Yes.
I'm not going to ask you again about infidelity.
These do seem to be emerging themes constantly.
So what's next? Are you working on a novel, as so many short story writers seem to be?
That seems to be what I'm supposed to say now is, yes, the novel to come. But I'm actually interested in writing more literary criticism. In fact, I began as a literature student, and I'm also interested in writing more stories.
Because the short form appeals to you?
It does. I think there's a compression and a lyricism that definitely appeals to me. I do write some poetry on the sly, and I just find myself kind of pulled toward the story. I also can get in and out of a story very quickly, and if I have to throw it away, it's not so devastating as throwing away 250 pages.
Jamie Quatro's collection is called I Want to Show You More. It is published by Grove Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.